Rick Sanchez here. This is Direct Impact, and this is what we're going to be talking about.
America's winning, and the world's better off for it.
That's President Joe Biden on his last leg, uttering a message which sounds almost as old as he is. I'm Rick Sanchez. Let's do this thing. So here's how this thing works, for those of you who don't know. About every 4 years in the United States, political parties right here in this country put on a show. That's what it is. It's a show. If you're wondering what a show has to do with politics or why there are only two parties, then you're beginning to understand just how horribly wrong American politics has been going. We told you about the Republicans, right, a couple of weeks ago? Well, now it's a Democrat's turn. Conventions, you see, they used to be newsworthy. News would actually come out of these things. That's where we learned who the president would be or who the vice president would be. I mean, in terms of candidates for each party, that's when they announced them. That's when they chose them. People voted. They also had a platform that they would put together. The platform means what the party stands for. What are their issues going to be? What are they going to care about? That's all gone. There's none of that anymore. So now, in essence, there's no news. I mean, unless, of course, there's a little more of this.
Y'all can do better than that. Mike DeMonte!
150,000 people are dead. You are funding a genocide. The Harris Biden administration keeps funding money to Israel.
That is a peace protester going up on stage during an event there at the DNC. Demanding a ceasefire and an end to the U.S.-sponsored massacre of more than 100,000 people in Gaza and Palestinians. Given that today's Democrats have become much more pro-war than pro-peace, it's likely that no one's going to listen to that protesters. But there may be more of this as these events in the days to come starts to get more TV time, as more networks start to cover this. See, usually, and let me take you through this, because I've covered so many of these that I kind of know. Usually on the first night of this convention, not a lot of people are watching. America's not tuned in. You know, I myself watched a lot of baseball last night. So that's when we see on that night, Monday, the speakers that the party feels compelled to include, to put in there, but who at the same time, they kind of want to hide. They don't want to show these people off. People like, in this case, oddly enough, the President of the United States, who's actually being applauded here, as you're about to see, for stepping aside.
Thank you.
Isn't that weird when politicians do that fake pointing thing, you know? Especially when, like in his case, when somebody does it actually like in slow motion. Anyway, Grandpa then got to talking, or actually in his case, yelling.
Name me a country in the world that doesn't think we're the leading nation in the world. Without America, not a joke, think about it. I'm being literal. Who could lead the world other than the United States of America? Well, guess what? America's winning, and the world's better off for it.
Not a joke, okay? Not a joke. He's being literal. Talk about an old message from an old guy. I mean, he screamed out the entire speech, and then he said that we need to run the world. Only the U.S. can run the world. Nobody else has the right to run the world. Only we can run the world. That's not patriotism, by the way. That's self-centered, braggadocious hegemony. How do you think that makes other countries all over the world feel when they hear this guy say something like that? Anyway, the other Monday speaker was none other than a failed presidential candidate, Hillary Clinton. And to show how American politics have become more than just anything else, a cult of personality, look at the reception that she receives. And you'd think she was Patton.
Please welcome former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
You know, I'm going to bring my partner Manila in now. Manila, you know, I thought of you last night as I was watching this. You remember that scene? There was a promo when they came out with Jaws 2, the movie Jaws about the shark that eats people. And it was like, she's back. And that's what I thought last night when I saw someone that we haven't seen for quite a while there on TV. The crowd liked her.
Well, was Jaws a girl? Rick, I always thought Jaws was a boy.
I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't want to get down there and check.
I don't know, but in this case, I think that is an appropriate comparing Hillary Clinton to the great white person-eating shark, Jaws. I think that's the perfect. I mean, she swims through the murky waters out of nowhere, just comes and strikes and tears down countries and overthrows leaders. It's the perfect comparison, Jaws. Yeah. I never thought about that, but you're right. She has, though, unfortunately for us, been constantly swimming in the waters here in the U.S. She has never actually gone away. And I would say that ever since her run in 2008 when she failed against Barack Obama and obviously later again in 2016. 2016, I think, is when the Democratic Party took a turn for the Clintonian corporatist style democracy, if we want to call it that. It's very corporate heavy, corporate friendly, and war, as you said, war friendly as well. I think she is actually the standard bearer of the party at this point. So even though, you know, she's a multi-time loser in the presidential elections, she's still very much representative of what the establishment Democratic Party wants for the state, for the state of this union.
Yeah, and very statist, and also from a foreign policy. I mean, her hands, her fingerprints, as you just alluded to, are in Ukraine, Afghanistan, Iraq,
Libya.
Oh my God, Libya. Yeah, it's funny, and yet people applaud her. And in that moment, I think I turned to my wife last night as we were sitting there watching some of this, and I thought, why don't they know that? Why don't they react to that? Because they really did make you think that she was like, you know, the second coming or something. Speaking of Ukraine, let's talk about Ukraine, you and I. All right, here we go. The Western media has been fascinated, as we've been reporting, and rightfully so, with this Ukrainian incursion into that area of Kursk in Russia, right? But while they have been looking there, the Russian military has been gaining. So much so that they're now on the brink of taking the most important city in terms of battle strategy in that part of Ukraine, which is why now even I was monitoring all the networks, as I often do. I get paid to do that, you know. The Canadian news networks are now turning their attention there. Watch this.
Start really by saying that a lot of the focus over the last 11 days or so has been on the Russian region of Kursk and the Ukrainians' incursion there. But now the attention, it seems, this morning has shifted back to Ukraine, back to the Eastern Front, back to Donetsk region, and specifically back to the city of Pokrovsk, because that is where it is a very important logistical hub for the Ukrainians. It serves as an important supply route for Ukrainian forces and really supports their operations in that particular part of the world. But Natasha, it's also a place this morning where the authorities are really, really sounding the alarm, because Russian troops, we are told, are advancing at a very fast pace towards Petrovsk and to other settlements in the nearby area as well.
So there you have it. So Pokrovsk, right? Say it with me. Ready? Pokrovsk. Get to know it, because you're going to be hearing a lot about this. It's important. Let me show it to you on a map. Put that map up, Victor. There it is. Pokrovsk is a major hub for the Ukrainian army. It is a command post, really, from where the soldiers, the hardware, the ammo is all dispensed. It's in the center of about two or three very important roads that go to different areas, so obviously that's why they chose it. And as you can see on this map, you see that the Russian military has already taken control of most of eastern Ukraine. Many people there, by the way, and you may not know this, you may know this, they speak Russian, not Ukrainian, and they identify as Russian. Here, let me read to you now from the Associated Press story what they're writing about this situation right now. And this is a quote, right? They say that Russian forces are advancing so quickly that even families in the area now are being given orders to leave the city, as well as towns and villages in the surrounding area. It says that people of all ages are now boarding trains and buses, whatever belongings they can carry to get out, you know, before the fighting, before the troops arrive there. Now, let me say something about this, because this is important. This is important to note that unlike the U.S.-fed bombing of civilians in Gaza, Russians seem to be waiting for the civilians to be evacuated before they bomb or before they enter the city of Pokrovsk. That's interesting, Manila. At least I find that fascinating. Not the kind of stuff that anybody's talking about, but, you know, and listen, war is war, and it's hell, and people die, and it's not nice, and civilians will get killed in these things. But, you know, at least it seems like it's, if there can be such a thing as order in a war, this is kind of it.
Yeah, absolutely, Rick, especially when you compare and contrast it to what's going on along the Gaza Strip, and now even into the West Bank. The big difference here is that Russia is not taking the same tact as Israel, where they're just kind of carpet bombing the whole area, civilians be damned. What Russia has been doing, and it's objectively measurable, has been taking, you know, very measured strikes and counterstrikes. And this has been a very controlled operation from the get-go. That's why the death toll numbers between what's happening in Ukraine versus what's happening in only 8 or 9 months in Gaza, the numbers are so disparate. The death toll in Gaza is well over 100,000, surely, at this point, and nowhere near that as far as civilian death toll goes for Ukraine. So when you're taking these proactive steps to shield civilian life, but yet still get called some kind of war criminal for I don't know what reason, but yet Benjamin Netanyahu does not. I think this goes to show, obviously, that the media has been completely one-sided on this whole argument from the get-go. But now they're being forced to be a little more honest because we have the Gaza issue to contrast it against. So what we're seeing in Pokrovsk is that they are waiting slowly for the civilians to be able to leave because there is still, I would say, a sense of kinship, I think, between what people in Russia feel towards their Ukrainian brethren. But unfortunately, I don't think that feeling is reciprocated, Rick.
Yeah, no. And that is the situation right now. And it's important. And I'm envious of you. You always pronounce these names better than I do for some reason. I think you must have just some kind of facility for it that I don't. Thanks, partner. Always good to talk to you, Manila. Appreciate it. We're going to take a quick break right now, and then you know what we're going to do? We're going to focus on Russia and Ukraine, and we're going to talk to somebody who is, interestingly enough, Ukrainian. He is Ukrainian, yet he understands this issue as an insider and doesn't necessarily look at it just one way. His name is Andrei Telechenko. He's a whistleblower. He's also an ex-Ukrainian diplomat, and he's going to be joining us. There you see him when we come back from Switzerland. Stay right there. Before I go to my guest, something just came in that I want to share with you, and since we're on the topic of what Russia is now doing vis-a-vis what Ukraine did and how Russia is responding. I want to show you. I just told you that they're about to take that very important town, which is a military hub for Ukraine, and that's going to be obviously very costly for the Ukrainian military. Something else has just come in. And before we go to it, let me tell you what it is. It's essentially, as it's being described, it's a Russian airstrike that's just taken out a huge Ukrainian command post in the Sumy region. It's where the 47th Mechanized Brigade, the command post for munitions depot, and where all the Ukrainian leaders, you know, the generals and the lieutenants are, one would imagine, the military personnel in that area. They were just hit with this amazing strike, and I think most of them obviously have been killed. But here it is. Let's watch this. Amazing to watch, isn't it? I mean, as you're looking at this, you're thinking, wow. Apparently, it was from a guided missile, a supersonic Su-34 multipurpose jet deployed to glide bombs against this target. Now, the reason I wanted to share this with you was because it's interesting that Russia is not over-responding to the Kursk region where the Ukrainians are going into their territory. They're kind of letting that be, because if the attempt was by Ukraine to try and get Russia to move its troops into that region and start fighting it, they're not taking the bait. Looks like, no, they're actually continuing to do what they were doing before going into Ukraine, which is, you know, an interesting strategy. I'm not a military expert. I don't understand the Ukraine terrain. But I'm joined now by somebody who can talk to us perhaps a little bit about this. Andrei Trelichenko, he's an interesting story in and of itself. You see, he's Ukrainian, and he used to be a Ukrainian diplomat. He's since become much more independent of a voice when it comes to this situation, and he's good enough to join us now from Switzerland. Andrei, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on, Mr. Sanchez. Always a great pleasure to be on your show.
It's a pleasure to have you, sir. So you saw what I just showed there. You know, you would have thought, right, that the Russians, given what just happened to them in the Kursk Oblast, would have been pulling troops back. Instead, they seem to be continuing their push through that eastern portion of Ukraine. How do you explain that, or what are your comments on that?
So you have to understand, the Kursk Oblast part, which is only 40 kilometers wide and up to 15 kilometers in some places in depth. It's even less than that in some other places. So it's a small little portion of a huge Kursk region, our first, and also a huge territory as Russia. And that's one thing. You have to understand the tactics of the Russian forces are much the same as they were during the Soviet times, but upgraded with today's reality. You had the Russian and Soviet army taking the Berlin, and they still had the German Nazi army in the Baltics there fighting, and they continued. They won the war, but they were still fighting going on inside Soviet territory. So this is a tactic today. Continue to move forward, whatever the cost is. And the cost is for the Russian military much less than for the Ukrainian military. It's 1 to 9, 1 to 8 compared, because I just spoke and traveled throughout Europe and spoke to some people from NATO. 120,000 to 150,000 from military forces Russia has lost, and 950,000 Ukrainian military have died just within this whole past 2.5 years. So there's a dramatic change to what's happening. Ukraine just throwing their forces into a meat grinder like Kursk, trying to win an attention and get Russian forces to mobilize and throw them out, because they think it's going to be a shame for Putin and the Russian government to have foreign forces on their soil, which it is. But yeah. They didn't take the bait. They're moving forward. They're continuing to protect their borders. Crimea is the first priority also, because I think that's where the next hit from the so-called Kyiv regime is going to come, and they're going to try to show their so-called allies in America that they can fight and try to get Russia, target Russia, whatever they can. So today, the moves in Kursk are not as tragic for Russia than they are as tragic for Ukraine. Ukraine lost just the Kursk invasion. More than 4,000 soldiers within last week.
But the media, except for today, as I showed you, Canadian television, the BBC, not yet in the United States, but other networks are now starting to turn their attention toward Pakrovsk, for example, instead of Kursk. And now with this other bombing that I just showed, what's the message that's being received, you think, worldwide as they see Russia taking more territory and destroying these key military outposts. You know, I'm talking about the NATO countries. I'm talking about Germany, who, by the way, is, as we speak, indicating that they no longer want to support Ukraine anymore. But is that kind of stuff important to them, these images that we just talked about?
The top military aides of the country and diplomats know what's happening. The media, if journalists do want to know, they do know, but a lot of people are getting blocked from information at all, understanding what is the real case of happening in the situation on the ground. That's for me speaking to people here on the ground in Europe. From what I understand, thank God Germany is taking some cool off of the situation and basically starting to look at what's happening in their own country and looking at what people want in their own country, not looking forward to the war in Ukraine and to financing the Kiev regime. But the media is being blocked. I can tell you there's an order from the Kiev government, from Zelensky, for not having foreign media in the Donbas area or in the front lines. So they're choosing where to take those foreign journalists and taking them out to show the picture and then take them back. There's no Ukrainian journalists or military journalists out there because there's an order from the government not to let anybody to the front lines except if the government wants them to. So there's a totally different situation from the propaganda-wise of the so-called West democracy in Kiev and what we see from the Russian side, where you have journalists from their side being killed and destroyed almost every day because they are there showing the real picture on their territory. And what's happening in Pokrovsk today, I think this is astonishing for a lot of people who took the bait from the propaganda, even the journalists themselves. I speak to Wall Street Journal, I speak to Washington Post, New York Times. They don't understand what's happening on the ground in Ukraine. I try to explain to them. They don't. They get what the editors tell them to get. That
is, yeah, and they arrive with a bias as well. I'm fascinated by you, Andre. You are a fascinating character in many ways, because you're Ukrainian, and yet you've, I guess, turned against the Ukrainian government for sure. I'm not going to say you've turned against your country. I believe deep down you still probably adhere a loyalty to your motherland, I suppose. But why have you turned against the Ukrainian government and the Zelensky government as much as you have? We're down to 3 minutes, but can you tell us?
I saw the situation happening on the ground since 14. We spoke about it last time until 2017. I was there on the ground. I saw how they were selling off to the Americas. The Poroshenko regime, the Zelensky regime, it's not a government anymore.
Yeah.
I cannot tell them that they are my government because I was working with people who financed Zelensky to become the president. I was having breakfast when Zelensky became the president the next day. He offered me a position to be deputy head of foreign intelligence. I denied that position. Mm. I saw that from the inside. I did not want to be part of the bloodbath that is happening in my country. I was trying to stop this war when it was going full force, and I understood that we're not going to be able to make it, but I at least had a chance and strategy to come up in the air and go public with this and to stop whatever's going to be happening in Ukraine, to warn as many people that I could, and know that my hands would be clean from the blood that is on the hands of today's regime in Ukraine, Zelensky, Poroshenko, all those neo-Nazi groups that are controlling the country today. And I'm calling neo-Nazi groups, not because it's in the media, but because they are pulling all these assess Galichina, Bandera people to the and making them heroes in my country, which they're not. My grandfather fought against this. My family fought against this. And I will fight for a country, Ukraine, to be a normal country, not just some patsy in the hands of the West to be used to try to make a war, proxy war against Russia, which a country which we are neighbors and not and more than that, we're connected with a religion. Orthodox religion, which today is being banned and was banned in Kyiv by the Kyiv regime, totally. And that is a tragic situation which we're seeing today in the dark history.
All I can ask you for is a yes or no answer. The thinking now, even in the West, is that it won't be long and it's going to be impossible for Ukraine to win. Yes or no? Do you agree?
Ukraine has lost already when the war started.
Wow. Andrei Telechenko, what an honor, what a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you, sir. What an interesting story. Thanks for taking time to take us through this.
Thank you, Mr. Sanchez. God bless.
That's our show. Remember to always be looking outside your own box. Truths, they don't live in boxes, as we like to say. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we'll be looking for you next time.